The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Hi. Someone told me a little story or incident that teaching that someone discovered for themselves, or maybe they were told. And it was that the person had trouble with self-trust, had distrust for themselves, or distrust for the world. I don't know. The person had the issue of distrust. And to counter it, thought that what was necessary was to cultivate trust. So how do you do that? In what area of life do you develop trust? Where do you develop trust? What are the steps for developing trust? All kinds of things. And then one day the person discovered that there was no need to develop trust. All the person had to do was to stop distrusting. So the point of the story is that sometimes we set up these dichotomies, dualities. We have something that we think is undesirable, and we think the opposite has to be there. And sometimes there's an easier way. And the easier way here was the suffering came from the distrust. It didn't have to be replaced with trust. In this circumstance, it was enough to let go of the distrust. Distrust here was an activity of the mind. And it was an activity of the mind maybe which was not needed. To cultivate trust seems like a good thing to do, seems like a logical thing to do, but it comes along with complications of various types. Maybe it's just easier to stop distrusting. So there are people for whom there's a lot of self-criticism, a lot of even self-hate. And so some people think, well, the solution is to have acceptance, to accept myself. And there's something logic to that. And so they work on acceptance. And that can be sometimes maybe easily done, and sometimes it's challenging to do it. But maybe there isn't to stop suffering, there isn't a need to accept oneself. All we have to do is let go of the self-hate. The self-hate is an activity. We don't have to swing the pendulum to the other side. And one of the difficulties of swinging to the opposite is what comes with us is the idea of self. Self-hating, there's a self. And sometimes it feels like that. And then there's self-acceptance, and the self is right there. And what might happen then is a reinforcement of some idea of self that might itself be a source of suffering or challenge. And they found that in raising kids now. There used to be a whole movement in the schools and other places of developing, cultivating, encouraging self-esteem in children. And the people who first came up with this idea are now a little bit horrified at what the result has been. And so, you know, logically, it seems like there's a logic to develop it if there's a lot of low self-esteem. But what's happened with the self-esteem movement in certain circles is now these kids feel deserving. They feel like, I have self-esteem, I'm great, I'm wonderful, and I don't have to work at anything. Things should come easily to me. And apparently there's a little generation or sub-generation of kids that they've seen who, when they come into college, they have some trouble because of they've gone through too much of the self-esteem thing. So certainly a poor self-esteem should be overcome. But maybe it doesn't have to be overcome by high esteem. Maybe it just has to be overcome by not having poor esteem. So, but is it enough? Is it okay just to, not have just to stop mistrusting? Is it enough just to stop hating oneself? Is it enough just to stop having poor esteem? There has to be something. So when people do mindfulness practice, sometimes the same challenge arises. Because mindfulness practice, the way it's generally taught, it's a personal practice. It's like what you do with your own mind. You pay attention to your body, the physical sensations here. You pay attention to the reactions of your mind. And you're told if you can cultivate mindfulness and non-reactive attention, then you can manage much better at work, in challenging situations, with stress. And so you're learning to manage by tracking what's going on here. This can be very wise, and certainly I teach this sometimes. But if what the message someone hears or what's passed on is that the self, is going to learn these skills, that self-management, learn skills of self-cultivation, learn skills of self-monitoring and self-development, and kind of be able to be in charge of your life, be the agent who's going to negotiate and manage. And it's up to you to figure out how to go through difficult situations, maybe difficult situations at work, that no one should go through. But you've learned mindfulness. And so you're able to stay relaxed and remember to breathe. And even though work is basically an oppressive environment and people are expecting you to work 14 hours a day, and you've learned to relax, you've learned to breathe, you've learned to recognize how tension arises. And so you become a wonderful support, maybe for the capitalist system, by having cultivated this wonderful mindfulness. Isn't that nice? We have stress-free capitalists. That's wonderful. But we're still left with capitalists, which has its benefits and has its downside. But from a Buddhist analysis, the concern is not necessarily with capitalism, but one of the concerns is with the self that's developing. And sometimes this practice can actually support a certain narcissism in people. So if people feel like I have too much to deal with this. So in Buddhism, there's a very interesting teaching around this whole idea of self or conceit. Buddhism teaches that there's a problem with having what we in English would call conceit, which in Buddhism is meant high conceit, the conceit that you're special or better than others. And most of the people in this kind of scene here, world, will agree that somehow having too much conceit, too much arrogance, and feeling that you're special and you lord over people is a problem. And people sometimes don't want to spend time with people like that. It's uncomfortable. But the Buddhist analysis says there's a different kind of conceit than they kind of being better than others. There's a conceit of feeling you're worse than others, inferior to others. And Buddhism considers that a form of conceit too, because it is a conceiving of self. It's a way of thinking of oneself, holding on to an idea, I'm this kind of person who is unworthy, lower than everybody else. And that's a way of being trapped in the suffering of self that can be as bad, maybe worse, than sometimes it's trapped in the high conceit trap. That's also a kind of suffering. But this gets more interesting in the Buddhist analysis. Buddhism also says there's a kind of suffering that comes if you think of yourself as equal to others. Uh-oh, what's left? Now these Buddhists are getting, now it's not making any sense, right? I mean, you kind of along with this, don't be better than others, don't be worse than others, but we should all be considered as equal to each other, and that's the ideal, to be equal. To a certain degree, it's true, there's a kind of truth that I want to kind of knock the idea completely, but it's very easy for that to be more of the self game. I am here, you are there, and we are equal. And now there's a different kind of conceit, the conceit of holding on to a view, an idea, of who I am in relationship to other people. And the view is that we're equal. And in certain situations, that's a problem, for sure. I would be in big trouble if I decided that I was equal in certain ways to my 15-year-old son. And decide that since we're equal, I should also be able to pole vault 10 feet. And I probably, you know, break my back or something if I tried that, but he seems to go over just fine. So, you know, there's ways in which we're not equal, and so there's certain ways which we're not equal because we have different abilities, different capacities, we're all equal. So I'm just equal to the local physician, and if you need surgery, come to me. So maybe these examples I'm giving are a little bit silly, but the Buddhist thing that Buddhism points at is the problems that come with excessive adherence, attachment to the notion of self or self-identity, how we represent ourselves, how we believe what we are. And that sometimes the alternative is simply not to play the game of self, not to be involved in it. So where there's three kinds of conceit, the alternative to being better, worse, or equal is not to compare. And are there times where it's actually helpful not to be comparing oneself to others? Or comparing others to oneself, but rather just meeting people fully and openly and clearly and kindly without establishing any kind of hierarchy, including equal, just here as people. So in Buddhism, there's this teaching on that's very perplexing for many people, that's sometimes called the teaching of not self, sometimes no self. And people are get sometimes quite perplexed. But there's two ways of looking at the Buddhist teachings around self. One is philosophically and one is psychologically. Philosophically, that's where people get into a quagmire of concerns. But is there a self? Is there no self? There's no self, how can that be? What's the existential true reality of the self? And that's a kind of more philosophical question to kind of sort through. The Buddhist approach, this whole thing of self, even though it might seem like Buddhism takes a stance on this, the Buddhist approach is more psychological in the sense that it's trying to understand the psychological forces and conditions in the mind and what's actually going on here. And if you turn the mindfulness to look at what's happening in the mind, it can reinforce a sense that I'm in charge, I'm the one who's doing the looking, especially if teachers or the teachings are told, be the observer, watch your experience, be the watcher, you're in charge and all that. But if it's possible to have attention, awareness, without the activity or the idea of there being an observer to the watching. They're just watching. And if the attention turns inward to feel and sense what's here, then if you're paying attention in the right direction, you can feel the suffering, the contraction, the tightness, the wind drag, the limitation that comes from being caught up, holding on to identity, self-identity, that I'm this way, or I'm supposed to be this way, or I'm going to prove myself, or I'm going to apologize for myself, or I'm going to defend myself, or I need to be this, or I shouldn't be this way. I can't, you know, I'm an embarrassment to humankind. You know, all these kinds of ideas and thoughts that are kind of sometimes a whole constellation of thoughts and ideas, some culturally learned from our society and family, some developed through life experience, some through, I don't know where it comes from, but we latch onto these ideas. And if you're paying attention to this, you can feel how the actual movement of clinging or attachment that's operating in there. So rather than questioning it philosophically, the Buddhist is questioning, should I be clinging? Should I be holding on? Should I be contracted around this thing? And it gets quite subtle as the meditation practice gets deeper and deeper. So the coarser aspect of this is when we say, I am, and you fill in the blank. So I am, you know, a plumber. So I got to be a plumber, and I'm the good plumber, and you should know that I'm the best plumber in Redwood City, and I got to prove it to you, and that's why I have the good plumbing truck. Whatever, you know, all this stuff, you know, that the plumber is kind of like my identity. And so the more preoccupied I am with this identity, the more I can feel the toll it takes on the inner life. It takes work to have and hold on to an identity too strongly, or insist on it and assert it and defend it and all the different things. And so as we start seeing the toll and the impact inside, then sometimes we can drop I am X. Just I am. So that's nice. And some people then champion how wonderful it is to just am. Just, you know, be aming. As the mind gets quieter, even the idea of I that's part of am is just too much. The sense that even there's no identity, there's no not building up a structure of identity around it, just I am. And I had a wonderful story of many years ago of visiting a friend whose young daughter was, I don't know, she was maybe just shy of two or something, and she was just beginning to speak. She had a few words. She could talk a little bit. And I pointed to different people in the room and said, who's that? Daddy. Who's that? Mommy. Who's that? And I pointed to different people she knew, and she named them. And then I pointed to her and said, who's that? And she said, I am. And I thought that was nice, so, but I, you know, it wasn't the answer I wanted. So I asked again, but who are you? And she said a little bit more forcefully, I am. So I was slow to catch on. So I asked a third time, and she raised herself up kind of strong and upright, a little bit indignant, and said, I am. Okay. And for the moment, she was my teacher. So I thought that was wonderful. But there was a kind of assertion there. And it turns out that even a little bit sense of I in the emness is extra. It's an extra activity of the mind. And that activity of the mind is little pieces of pressure or stress or tension. It gets even more subtle. Even the sense of emness is too much. And if the mind is really quiet and still, even the little activity, because it's any kind of sense like that is a little activity, a little movement, a little doing of the mind. And even that can be put down. And generally they say that when that goes put down as well, that then a mind has an experience of freedom. A mind which is not defined by anything or trying to do something or be something. And this is one of the things that the Buddha was pointing to, was the ability to be alive, clear, present, engaged in the world, without having a definition for oneself, without limiting oneself by a definition, this is what I am. And the Buddha himself was very reluctant to, maybe reluctant is not the right word, but he wasn't inclined to be put into a category of ordinary definitions of who he is. And the most common way the Buddha referred to himself was not by his given name and not by the title Buddha, it's just a title, but he referred to himself, which would be probably just as strange in ancient India as it would be if I said that to you, who are you? And I said, the one who is thus. So it's like you come up to someone and say, you know, who are you? And they say, like so. you know, it's like, that's not the definition. It's like, it's just like so, like such. Or the word is tata, thus, just thus. And so that's about pretty minimal in terms of getting any information about someone. But maybe there's something profound to not be defined, to not be limited by a name, by a word, by a role, by a concept, by anything. And so if Buddhist practice, mindfulness practice, takes us in this direction, then it becomes the antidote to conceit. And then the Buddhist practice doesn't lead to a certain narcissism. It doesn't add to the conceit that I'm in charge, I have to do things. And it's a kind of a little bit of a tyranny to learn these kinds of Buddhist mindfulness teachings and now think that your whole happiness, your whole well-being is all dependent on you monitoring yourself, noticing where you're attached and letting go. I mean, that's a big responsibility. So here's, you know, the alternative. I don't know if I can do this effectively, but maybe you'll let me try. If I try to walk, maybe along Highway 1, the coast here, up to San Francisco, with a very, very, very big flag. And generally, let's say on the coast here, there's usually generally gale force winds. But it's pretty strong, but I have this flag. And so I'm holding on to this flag. And the wind blows. And then there's people who don't like the flag. And they're yelling at me. And there's people who like the flag, and they stand in my way with my autograph. And I can't get going. See, either the wind is blowing on it, and the people who hate me, the people who love me, and sometimes they're fighting and they get in the way of me walking up to San Francisco. And so I'm trying to get to San Francisco, but so, and then my flag starts ripping in the gale wind, so I go back to town and get another one, and I have to start over again all the time. It's just complicated, this world with this flag. So Buddhism sometimes likens conceit, identity, this attachment to self, to waving a flag. And possibility is put the flag down. If you put the flag down, the wind is not going to be such a big issue. You can walk. If you put the flag down, the people who like and dislike that flag are not going to be caught up in it so much. So I'm not sure these examples are the best ones to use given what goes on in our society. But I think the principle is that if you hold up, sometimes when things happen to us and we're holding up a strong sense of self, things happen in the world and come to us and they hit that flag, hit that holding up. So if I need to be the best plumber in Redwood City and my whole self-esteem and place in town and status and everything is dependent on that, how good I am as a plumber, then someone comes along and does a Yelp review of me that is not so good. Well, that Yelp review just comes and hits inside of me that place of self. What happens if I'm not trying to be the best plumber and someone says something about how poor a plumber I am? It just goes right through. Or they tell me, you are the best plumber in Redwood City. It just goes right through. It doesn't hit the place. There's no place where it gets stuck. So rather than self-improvement, in a certain way, Buddhism is about dropping the flag. Now, does that make us nobody? Does that make us kind of uninteresting? Does that make it impossible for us to take care of ourselves? Are we now just a pushover for what goes on in the world? And are we not, you know, supposed to assert ourselves or be in the world in any kind of way? We're just empty. And I don't think that's the case at all. We have within us, there's all kinds of forces within us, all kinds of, there's empathy, there's feelings of fairness, feeling of justice, of kindness, of compassion. There's a lot of different things that operate here. There's also forces of hate, forces of prejudice, forces of greed, and all kinds of things that operate as well. If we're doing this careful work inside paying attention, we'll see that more often than not, the afflictive emotions of greed, hate, and delusion are usually entangled with this idea of self. They can be there without it, but often that's part of the little nexus or little kind of complex they're working together for each other. And that if there's no attachment to self, there's much less, the mind is less alienated. We're more in touch with ourselves. We're not caught up in these desires of self, the abstractions and concepts and stories that go along to building up the self. If we're not caught up in those stories and ideas and everything, then generally we have more capacity to touch into the beneficial forces within us. The empathy, the compassion, the kindness, the generosity, the wisdom, the love that can be here. And with the mindfulness practice, you can physically feel the difference between a mind that is greedy and a mind that's generous, or a heart that is has hate, or a heart that has love. It feels, there's a whole, you know, qualitative difference. One, if you're really attentive, feels like picking up hot coal. And why would you do that? The other feels like, you know, a nice spring day and refreshing and nice. So if, when we don't have the self, active, the self-identity is, you know, really attached to it and clinging to it and building it up and all the different things that can make it complicated, one of the things that is lessened is fear. And it's said that a person who's liberated is a fearless person. And if you're fearless, and if you don't feel like you're trying to defend yourself or protect yourself, it's much easier to step forward and say, stop, you can't do that. If we need to protest injustice, it's easier to stand up for oneself. You can't do that. You have to stop. The Buddhist kind of attitude towards people who are harming us, you know, it's not completely fair to kind of call on this idea, but maybe it's just for the purpose, pedagogical purposes, okay. There is some places where they have this idea that if someone hits you, turn the other cheek, kind of offer them the other cheek. Buddhism would never say that. But they would say, if someone hits you, turn and face them and look them right in the eye. Don't hit them back, but, you know, don't just stand there and offer the other cheek. Just, you know, stand your ground and look at them and say, what's going on here? Challenge them that way. Don't let them just kind of bowl you over. But you don't have to be assertive and attack either. Just that the ability to say no and stop, let's look at this and stand our ground, doesn't have to come from assertion. It can come because we're fearless. We're not holding on to anything. We're not trying to prove ourselves, but we're also no need to diminish ourselves. There's no need to say, oh, I'm not really up to it, or I'm not really worthy of this, or I'm supposed to be kind of, you know, a good Buddhist and not cause trouble. It's this idea of not self, or this dropping of this kind of caught up in selfness, leaves a person in a certain kind, from the external, looking from the outside, both strong and soft. Both receptive and able to stand up for themselves. Able to speak if speaking is what's needed. Able to be quiet if quiet is what's needed. And in fact, down through the ages, some Buddhists have been known to be very courageous, very strong people. The Buddha was, even though he said, you know, I'm just thus, was superbly confident. But is there a confidence that's not a so much a self-confidence? Or is there a confidence that comes from the absence of lack of confidence? Who are you if you leave yourself alone and just show up without the burden of being better or worse or equal? What happens if you show up without any fear around self-identity? What happens if you're just there? And this is one of the, you know, one of the things that I've started to learn through Buddhist practice. I was very much, when I was a very young, you know, my early 20s, started to practice, I was completely entangled in this whole world of self and self-identity and how people liked me and how I was approved by people and playing social games to try to convince people who I am, how they should see me, creating a sense of self. And I'm sure they saw me better than they could see me, who I was, but I was trying to pretend and be different than who I was. And it was a lot of work to do this. And it kind of really got to see it clearly when for the year that I was working in the monastery kitchen. Kitchens are pressure cooker places. And I became kind of the kitchen manager, managed all the other cooks, which is really bad. Managing cooks in a kitchen, that's tough. And you know, you had this deadline getting the food out at a certain time, and you had this production, you know, you couldn't just kind of say, oh, you know, take your time, we'll do it tomorrow. But, you know, we had to feed people. And so I would get so worn out until I realized that what I was doing was doing complicated social gymnastics in this very difficult social environment to try to ensure that everyone liked me. And I said, this is a lot of work. And I discovered it's a lot more easy to live life if you're not trying to get everyone to like you. It's kind of impossible anyway. And so now I don't try so much to get people to like me. So, you know, it'd be nice if you did. People do, but it's not like a big project. And you know, it's not really much of a concern for me. So the whole idea, this idea of selfing, in many ways, is beginning to drop away. So then, who am I? Who are we? Who can we be? And one answer to this question that they give in the kind of the Zen tradition is you are whatever you're doing in the moment. So if someone is sweeping the temple courtyard and they go up to them and say, who are you? Then Zen, the answer would just be, continue to sweep. You're not even the sweeper. You're just, the answer is in this doing the sweeping. So you discover who you are moment by moment in the activities that you're doing it. But when the activity is over, if the sweeping is over, you're no longer the sweeper. Then you go on to something else. But you are kind of defined by the moment you're in, but it's as ephemeral of what you're doing in the moment. So if you're a plumber, you're only a plumber when you're plumbing. When you leave work, you know, you don't carry that with you, kind of thing. So I think it's fair to say that there are parts of American culture, especially white American culture, that's very individualistic. Very strong sense of privacy, strong sense of self-efficacy, self has to manage, and it's a little bit, you know, and it's very hard to see how deeply ingrained the individualism is that exists in these circles of American and Western culture. I think some people who come from collective cultures, some of the cultures of Asia that way, there are other native people in this country and other cultures in this country that have this, they come into some of these strong individualistic white scenes in America, and it stands out and highlights, you know, wow, this is quite strong. But if people are in it, it's hard to see. It's just like, you know, it's like the air you breathe, you know, you don't see it or something. And I was lucky to see it. One of the dramatic times I saw it was when I was in a monastery in Japan. And Japanese culture is a very collectivist culture. So I grew up in a very strong individualistic kind of currents of culture. And I'm from Norway, and Norway, it's possible Norway has it even stronger than America in certain ways. In certain ways it doesn't. So I was in Japan, and in this monastery with 35 other Japanese, mostly young monks. And every morning we had to do a period of collective cleaning together. And it was a little bit of a ritual, because even if something was already clean, you cleaned it anyway. And so we had these columns that held up the roof of the temple. And those columns got cleaned. Each column got sometimes cleaned 4 or 5 times. You have these rags, and you'd clean it, and you go look for another one that was no one was cleaning, and you clean that one, even though it had just been cleaned by someone else. The idea was just to be working. You know, there was like full on. You had to work full on, and you know. But so it was very kind of fast and engaged. And so I was doing that for about 3 or 4 months with them every morning. And then one day, somehow, and I spent the whole, 24 hours a day we were living together. We slept in the same room, we ate in the same room, we bathed in a collective bathing situation. We were, so it was really living that life with them and kind of experiencing it. So maybe this contributed to really finally kind of grokking, understanding something. And one day I was doing this cleaning, and I suddenly kind of saw something I hadn't seen before. And what I saw was that I was operating as one individual among a collection of different individuals doing work. And they were operating first and foremost as a group of which they were a part of. So I was all these individual entities, and they had one entity, the group. And they were all elements that were working together. And how I saw that and how to explain it, I don't know how to tell you now, but I saw this very strong way in which they saw themselves as a unit. And I was, wow, I had no idea. This is like we're living in a little different social universes here. I didn't think that one of them was better than the other just automatically. I didn't put them on a... I kind of thought, well, every human society has to figure out some way so people can not bump into each other too much, or somehow, manage to work together and cooperate enough. And so there are different kind of stories and ideations and concepts we form, and so different cultures do different things, different ways. But it was very important for me to see it, because then I started to be able to question and see what I was doing. And then I more and more, especially as I continued my monastic practice and got quieter with my mind, I started seeing the subtle ways in which this idea of the self, the individual responsibility, agency, all these things were operating. And I could put a question mark behind it, or see it as a condition, see it as not absolute. And so kind of, not hold on to it so much and be able to put it down and when other things were suitable. So I think that, in these currents of Western culture that some of us are in, that where the strong individualism is here, a couple of things, it's hard to see. And the logic behind it is so embedded and deeply that sometimes it's, not only do we don't see it, but even Buddhist teachers, in teaching like mindfulness and Buddhist practice, sometimes are subtly reinforcing it because it's so deeply embedded. And I wonder what's going to happen now, because now things like mindfulness, secular mindfulness, clinical mindfulness, is getting more and more popular in all kinds of settings, and it's starting to be imported into other cultures. So some of the founders and leaders of this mindfulness, secular mindfulness movement, are being invited to places like China to teach mindfulness and to train people to do this, like mindfulness protocols, mindfulness-based interventions and stuff. But the big question is, are they bringing with them a Western individual idea of the self who does the practice and bringing it into a culture that doesn't have that sense of the individual. And what's going to happen with the meeting of those two? Especially what's going to happen when it's not explicit, or even the people who are propagating it don't even know what's happening. So you know, there are challenges in teaching this whole mindfulness thing in this kind of culture. And my hope is that people practice well. Because if you practice well, then at some point you'll start feeling the limitation of the self thing. You'll start feeling limitations of holding on and clinging to self-identity. Self-identity has a role, but it can be too much activity, too much mental turmoil and agitation and clinging and grasping and resistance and all this stuff going on with it. And so to learn to see it and drop it, to lower the flag. And then, if we're able to do that well, then the hope I have is that people will have the sensitivity to be able to respond appropriately to different cultures and different kinds of people they meet. We don't have to assert the being. Sometimes it's useful to show up as a strong, independent individual if you're in places where that's asked for. But you're just as happy to show up and be part of a community and a collectivist and a social thing, if that's what's called for, without holding on to a strong sense of self. People who come out of a collectivist culture, you know, Buddhism in Asia often was an antidote to some of the excesses of collectivist culture. And people often will step out of the collectivist mindset in Japan, for example, in becoming a Buddhist monastic. It's Americans, many Americans can't even imagine how radical it is for a Japanese young person to leave and go off and do full-time Buddhist practice. Here in America, we do that for a while, and then we go back, you know, to our life, and everything's waiting for us, kind of, where we can pick up. But there, you can't do that. You step out of the social nexus, and it's hard to come back. And but how to be fluid in all this? How not to be caught in anything? Not be caught in a collectivist identity, not to be caught in an individualistic identity, but to be fluid and respectful for all of them, knowing they have to, something like that has to be operating. And then how do we get fluid and, you know, improvise or play or move smoothly within it and be wise about it and be careful with the ways, subtle ways, which there's maybe it's conveying values or attitudes which are not helpful for people and maybe cause harm. So, mindfulness practice. Leaves you with nothing. Isn't that good news? In nothing, it's a kind of very nothing which is full of potential, full of being able to respond, full of being able to be fluid, full in being able to adapt and change appropriately. Without nothing, in a way that we can, there's more breathing room for whoever we actually are. There's lots of room to be who you are when you don't package it and limit it with holding on, draping yourself with the self, lowering the flag of conceit. So I hope this made some sense this evening. And it's a complicated topic. And what I was trying to do was point to the psychology of how this stuff works without making any kind of claim that there absolutely is no self or there is a self. Whether there is a self or is not a self, it doesn't really matter to someone who's free of self. it, let it show up whatever it, way it wants. Then we learn how to be wise and play with it. And if what I talked about this evening is perplexing, you're welcome to leave it here. If it's irritating, you're welcome to leave it here. But if it's irritating, it might actually be useful then. It might be something here for you to look at more deeply. You know, which flag did my teaching hit? Which flag are you trying to protect? Anyway, I hope I gave you something to think about and explore and consider in a nice way. Thank you.